Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're spending time in the cookbook aisle.
Yeah, we are.
We are. And a lot in the French cookbook aisle. And you've got big... We talked about technical books and good ones to learn from. We talked about inspirational books. You have very particular favorites also.
I do. One more book by Paul Bocuse is the Regional Cooking, French Cooking.
That's just awesome.
That was another one of the first books I ever got. And I have referenced that book so many times because he has Bœuf Bourguignon in there, these classic recipes.
You know, cuisine de grand-mère, real grandma's cooking from French regions.
Absolutely.
But he knows what he's a 3-star chef for, 40 years? And
He's the master.
Tremendous.
One of the masters. And Anne Willen is really one of my favorite cookbook authors. I learned so much from everything. And, you know, she had a cooking school in Paris, a brave woman. She was from England and grew up there and eventually just decided she wanted to open a French cooking school in Paris. And that was pretty seriously brave of her. And her books are teaching books for sure. So she has French Regional Cooking that I recently bought that I'm in love with. She also has La Varenne Pratique. And she has another book called The La Varenne Cooking Course, which, I mean, really, once again, has some good photographs, you know, how to truss a chicken, things that, you know, definitely, if you haven't ever done it, you want to see a photograph of it. And then she has a book called The Great Cooks and the Recipes, and it's from Escoffier to Taillevin. And just if you really want to learn about the history of French cooking, this is really special. And then she has The Country Cooking of France. She has a lot of cookbooks, but I think you can go well. You're going to be right on with any of them.
Her books are pretty interesting because they not only have a lot of technical details, but there is a lot of sort of romantic inspiration around cooking and entertaining and setting and the feeling of how to entertain in that style and some of the details of the real heart of getting it done. Those are pretty remarkable books.
Yeah, she has I assume she still has it at Chateau de Fay in Burgundy. And, you know, one of her cookbooks shows photographs of the interior of the chateau and sort of their reconstruction of that, what a big project it was, and the recipes that came from the land there in that region. And that is a really beautiful book.
Yeah, I mean, the history of cooking is a history of farming. I mean, that's, you know,
exactly.
it all ties. And that's one of the, when you have these long, slow, you know, millennial histories of... of dishes and regions tied to, you know, products and the long-time production. In France, it seems like we can get decent books and a lot of decent books. I've struggled a lot finding a lot of Italian books over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And all of my favorite, you know, and Italian cooking is obviously, I mean, honestly, commercially is more popular in the U.S. than French cooking.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the things that's changed over time.
You would think there would be more Italian cookbooks. You're right.
Well, but I mean, serious and historical and tied to,
right,
you know, tied to both, you know, Cucina della Nonna, grandmother's cooking,
yeah,
as well as serious regional things. And we still lack a lot of familiarity, a lot of in-depth familiarity with that.
Absolutely. And Sicilian cooking, too. You know, that's... I would love to see a great book on Sicilian cooking. It's so ancient.
It is that amazing sort of melting pot sort of thing. And the thing that happens is you get books out. They have some interesting photographs that are beautiful photographs of the place. But when you get into the details of how some of the recipes work out, like Locatelli's book is beautiful to look at, but there's not that much there. That's a big difference between a lot of the French authors that translate, you know, or American authors or British authors that are writing in English about French cooking. And I mean, I think all of my favorite Italian books to have worked from or to research in, you know, all are just in print in Italian.
Yes.
Or in Italian and German or...
Yeah, somebody needs to translate them into English for us so we can all read them. That'd
yeah,
be
I mean, I think probably the best old school one in English available now is Luigi Carnacina's Great Italian Cooking, La Grande Cucina Internazionale, which is, you know, I mean, it's a book from the 70s, and it's something of an Escoffier-like tome that just kind of says, well, if something's called this, you know, it means it has these ingredients, and this is basically where it's from. So as a reference, it's a reasonable reference, but...
Is there anything in particular from that book that... a recipe that you've taken, or just you just like it as a resource?
The details of different pasta recipes from different regions are nailed.
That would be great to have.
And important. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of, and what you start to realize, and one of the things that you find in the French books as well as you know, something like this, the details, like the simple things, the details in the actual content, what kind of salt,
Right.
What is the humidity? You know, how long ago was the grain ground? And what is the actual humidity of that grain? Because it's going to change the way anything comes out.
That's right.
It's crazy. Like, you have 2-3 ingredients in something: water, salt, and flour, and pasta. And every detail of those things, the exact temperature of the water, you know, the surface you're putting on, the temperature of the surface you're putting it on, you know, when you make that dough. I mean, it's the detail oriented. It's, you know, sort of, you know, memnotic.
Mm-hmm. But, well, and the regional aspect of that is so important because it is such an old world cooking.
Well, especially in the South, where you have, you know, you have so much poverty for so long. The number of products that they actually deal with outside of what they grow in some particular valley where people spend their entire lives for, you know, 30 generations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if they know how to grow butternut squash and they make this kind of pasta, I guarantee you there are 400 variations on exactly how to do the exact same dish, and it's been talked about thousands and thousands of times by the people there. And that does not get reflected in books that are not in Italian. And maybe that's something that, you know, there's a reasonable amount of the slow food editore, the movement that started in Italy. There's a lot of things that are interesting that are published on bits and pieces of cooking, but there's no one giant tome. I think probably the two most interesting ones in Italian that I think that you can begin to understand reasonably well, even without a lot of Italian. One is La Cucina Napoletana. And I think that's about to be translated.
Oh, good.
And the Francesconi is the author of that. That's a super remarkable book. And La Cucina della Dolomiti.
That's cooking. I would like to learn a lot
and
more
that's
the
Tyrolean cooking.
Yeah,
exactly. The Dolomites.
That would be really exciting to
cooking. That's one that I think is also, I was told last time I was up there that it was about to be translated into English also. And that, honestly, if you have little kids and you want to make something, make them happy, learn how to make knödel.
Yeah, right,
or
exactly.
Or the terrifying sort of pasta called Schlutzkrapfen.
Uh-oh, what's that? I don't remember having that when I was there.
It is the most terrible name. Schlutzkrapfen is almost like a cheese ravioli.
Okay.
Made in their style that's then fried in clarified butter.
Okay. I'd love to see, you know, 10 different recipes for Speck so that, you know, you could really, you know, see how a bunch of different people make it. What's their curing process,
yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
Talking about Italy and cooking, are there any wine books from Italy that you enjoy?
It's a little complicated. Sorry. That's why I sort of groan in the middle of that. It's the politics behind wine authorship and wine books and wine magazines and all that's a little complicated.
Okay.
There is a very good reference, but I think my favorite wine book, period, is the World Atlas of Wine by Hugh Johnson. That is just a great reference and teaches you an awful lot of the process without giving you judgments.
Right.
Which I think is really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
And gives you a bit of history and a lot of agricultural understanding.
And he has a new printing of his book. So it's, again, you can look for an old one if you want.
The oldest one that you can get from 69.
That's amazing.
I have one
book.
Of those copies. So,
yeah.
That's great. And see how it's changed in different printings over the years.
It's a little bit like the LaRousse. I think it's fun to have both of them.
The Italian thing that's sort of like, I would start with the World Atlas.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Italian thing, there's a slow food editore book called The Wine Atlas of the Lange, Lange.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lange is the region that's famous for Barolo and Barbaresco.
That's a good place to start.
Yeah.
Oof.
And what it does is start to explain all the geography and the crews, and the crews meaning the particular vineyard sites.
Of course.
And some of their qualities and who owns pieces of what. And just like the great food books, it's in touch with the agricultural history of the place. And that's something that the more that you begin to learn about food and wine, I think people get excited by food television, or they get excited by something loud or jazzy, or they want some, you know, bam taste or whatever. And the thing that's amazing, the thing that connects us at the table is that collected human history and collected human education that gets celebrated every time that we break bread. And every time that we pour wine into a glass and share that experience,
absolutely,
you know, that's the thing that is slow and that is honest and it is from the earth. And the more that it feels that way, the more connected we are to each other and to the earth that it all came from. And so when there are books that actually help you understand some of that process, then those are the things that are most inspiring to me in a wine book, not the ones that are the judgment of this and the judgment of that, because the judgment of Jim on, you know, XYZ wines and the numbers assigned to them, don't excite me as much as actually exploring that. That's the fun part.
Well, getting to know the winemaker, their personal story, their family history, as you said, the terroir, everything about it is really, really, really a beautiful, wonderful story to understand. You know, there's a DVD out called A Year in Burgundy, and I'm just in love with it. I'm enamored with it. First of all, it's beautiful. It shows all four seasons of the grape growing season in Burgundy, and the visuals are amazing. It's a phenomenal film.
Well, Burgundy is a pretty magical place, because it's a great place for, you know, both white and red wine. There are only so many places like that in the world, and both of which that age. But it's also a great place gastronomically. So there's everything is all tied, knit very closely together with the earth and the seasons. And that's and Burgundy is also historically a place of great commerce. And so there was enough wealth to support really interesting eating and drinking for, you know, millennia, which is kind of cool.
That is very cool. Let's talk a little bit about glassware, storing of wine, temperature of wine. Tell us a little bit your thoughts on that.
Well, I don't know if there's... I would almost back up and say that there... Glassware is super important, but I think actually, you know, we're talking about being connected at the table and sharing an experience. Whenever someone says to me, well, you know, I wouldn't appreciate that about some kind of wine, you know, that I'm always bothered by that because I don't believe that to be true. I believe that we all have senses that can be utilized, and you have to actually allow them to be utilized and connect with them. You have four actual, you know, different types of taste in your mouth, but you have 61 scent receptors that connect to your brain. You know, there's 65 different ways you can experience something that you actually taste if you allow yourself. But on the surface, you think, oh, I have, you know, I'm going to taste sour and bitter and salty and sweet, and that's it. That's
so
not the case
more.
Because,
right.
Yeah. Learning to taste, taking a class on learning to taste wine, that makes a giant difference, I think, because it's a little bit like taking a tennis lesson. You can watch the guy on TV, and then you go out to the court with a tennis ball, and you try to hit it, and you hit it over the fence, and you're like, whoop, I can't do that. If someone actually teaches you how to stand and how to look at the ball and how to swing your arm properly, you're probably going to learn how to do that, at least reasonably well. Mm-hmm. And you may not become a pro, but you may enjoy playing tennis for a long time. With wine, literally, it's a physical, you know, it's a physical interaction that you learn. And part of that process is also, I mean, you're going to enjoy it much more. If you have a little tiny television and you can barely see Gone with the Wind, the costumes are not so great. If you have some giant, ridiculous 75-inch set with great definition, you know, when she comes down the staircase, Scarlett is amazing, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
So it's the same thing with a wine glass, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a little dinky, you know, coffee cup and you pour something amazing in it, it may or may not taste great. If you're a super experienced taster and it's, you know, 1990 Montrocher from Domaine de la Romanée Conti, it may still taste great out of that coffee cup, and you may get all the details or may expect all the details. But mostly it's good to have a good, clean vessel that doesn't smell like soap, that doesn't smell like the cabinet that it came out of, that doesn't smell like the dishcloth that actually polished it.
Mm-hmm.
And have the wine at an appropriate temperature. And that usually means that the red is a little cooler than room temperature, somewhere in 55 to 63 degree range. Or the white is something that's a little warmer than refrigerator temperature, so more than 40, you know, something that's more like 48 to 55, 56.
Yeah, too cold white wine, you're just not going to taste it.
It's
period.
Super refreshing, yeah. But it's not interesting.
You're going to miss so much if it's super cold.
Even sparkling wine champagne, if it's super cold, it's super refreshing, but it's not that interesting. One of the reasons people like things very cold is 32 degrees is where your tongue actually notices sweetness more than any other temperature. So it's, I mean, physiologically, it's a, you know, it's a little bit of a, you know, it's going to taste more like high C at 32 degrees than,
oh, gee. What a shame.
than it is like really beautiful champagne. Part of the point of it is to get all the different flavors. It's, you know, if you're listening to a symphony played by two musicians is probably less interesting than being played by the 160 musicians and the Berlin Philharmonic.
Yeah, we
right?
want to hear all 60 for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, and what about reading the labels? You know, I think that can be very involved.
It can. I mean, when you first tasted wine, Cindy, what did you first learn as an American, as a young American wine consumer?
Oh, definitely about the varietal.
Yeah,
we're drinking a Chardonnay, we're drinking a Merlot, we're drinking, you know, Cabernet Sauvignon.
But you think it's a grape.
It's a grape.
one of the things from an American wine consumer's perspective is people plant grapes and they see what happens in this place. In other places in the world, like in Europe, if you see something that says Barbaresco, Barbaresco is the place. And in Barbaresco are different towns, and in or around those different towns are different particular vineyard sites, the crews that I'd mentioned. So from Treviso, maybe Gallina is one of the crews, a very particular vineyard site that Barbaresco comes from. The grape is Nebbiolo.
Mm-hmm.
But they've learned over hundreds of years to grow Nebbiolo in this place. You know, and it becomes, it's about place. So one of the almost disadvantages of learning about wine as an American consumer is when you read a label, you're looking for a grape when it's really, you have to slow down and take in the human story and the history of the place. And if you learn that, you learn the traditions of what grapes are grown where.
Right.
And that's how you read those labels, because you're looking for the place, the vintage, because the quality of the year and the harvest is going to affect this quality. The name of the producer, and it may be a family name or the name of some house, a chateau of some sort, or mm-hmm. Those are the things that you're looking for.
How can you tell if a wine is bad? If we say the word bad, I don't.
Well, corked wine, mm-hmm. wine that is actually where there's been an infection of the cork, smells like wet Adidas or wet cardboard or something. It's a pretty significant thing. It still kind of smells like wine behind that. But there is that sort of mushroomy, moldy thing.
I think that's such a big deal because even today, I still sometimes can't always tell if something is corked.
It's one of those things that in restaurants, for example, we taste everything the same way that you check every fish that comes in the back door to make sure the fish is perfect. We taste it because once in a while it's not, and we send it back. We taste wine to check to make sure it's correct before we serve it to guests, because about 1 in 20 is not.
And that's what the waiter is doing at tableside. Pouring a little bit of wine in that glass in front of the guests.
Exactly.
They're making sure it's good for the guests.
And we can get into that more when we come back.
Okay.
On Former Wolf on Food and Wine. We're going to come back. We have a producer segment with Joe Darty from Oregon, a mushroom forager with a really interesting story.
Yeah, that's going to be.
And a lot of listener questions. All that more on Former Wolf on Food and Wine.